Out sailing one day off the coast of Norway, two energy sector engineers had an unlikely idea. Make a buoy 100 feet tall and put a windmill on it. Now, almost two decades and millions of dollars of investment later, floating wind farms just might be the future of renewables.
It's a big deal because floating technology is just starting to come around, so it's really the next phase of wind energy development and maybe the end game for wind energy.
That's Walt Musial of the National Renewable Energy Lab, and this is The Future According to Now, a podcast from Atlantic Rethink, the branded content studio at The Atlantic, and Fidelity Investments. We're looking ahead. This podcast explores groundbreaking innovations that have real potential to change our lives in the foreseeable future, but not always in the ways you might imagine. Fidelity experts look beyond the expected implications to understand how these technological breakthroughs will impact the market and the investment space. In this episode, the wind energy sector has long been burdened with expensive materials and obtrusive design. But as technology advances, renewable experts may have found a whole new landscape to harness the wind, the deep sea. We'll talk to those on the cutting edge of offshore and floating technology, and a Fidelity investment expert who sees a buoyant future in renewables. I'm your host, Vicky Virgolina. Let's begin a little closer to shore in the realm of fixed-bottom offshore turbines. The offshore wind market in the United Kingdom is the most mature in the world and has the highest offshore wind capacity of any nation. Wind farms generate almost 8% of the UK's electricity demand. The Crown Estate manages 35 operational wind farms off of the UK shores and is a leader worldwide in wind energy production. To get a better sense of their operation, I caught up with Hoobden Royen.
I am Hoobden Royen. I am the Director of Energy, Minerals and Infrastructure at the Crown Estate in the UK. And in my department, we manage the seabed around England, Wales, and Northern Ireland.
I asked Hoob why harnessing the power of wind offshore caught on in the UK in particular.
If you look at the UK, it is a geological treasure trove. A lot of it is very sandy and it is not very deep, so it is an ideal place to build wind farms.
Hoob estimates the total area licensed for wind farms in the UK is just over 3,000 square miles, or around 3% of the seabed, leaving lots of opportunity for expansion.
Suddenly, offshore wind farms bring a lot of economic activity into the area. You get these small-scale ports and they get completely re-energized. And that's why local businesses are so keen on seeing this technology being developed. We have about 7.5 gigawatts of offshore wind operating in 35 offshore wind farms.
A gigawatt is equivalent to 1,000 megawatts, or about 100 million LED light bulbs.
And that 7.5 gigawatts provides about 7.5% of national electricity consumption. The industry believes that it can develop 50 gigawatts by 2050, which in real terms means that you're looking at half of all electricity being consumed in the country coming from offshore wind by the middle of the century.
The explosion of offshore wind energy productivity that experts like Hoob expect to see over the next several decades all stems from the perfect marriage of cost reduction in the wind turbine industry and a growing efficiency and reliability. This combination of a maturing market and future potential has captured the attention of equity analysts like Pranay Kirpalani of Fidelity. He covers the European infrastructure, utility, and energy services sectors.
We do a combination of fundamental research and go to conferences and meet companies. And the end goal there is to come up with a list of recommendations that we basically present to portfolio managers that help decide their investment process. And they buy or sell those securities and their funds based on our recommendations.
It's through this lens that Pranay sees Europe as a real leader in this shift to offshore wind energy production.
90% of the offshore wind globally is actually in Europe, and the biggest markets are Germany, which is about 30%, the UK is about 35%, and then Netherlands. So it's been pretty exciting. We've basically gone from nothing to about 20 gigawatts of kind of global capacity, and Europe has kind of led the charge there.
Pranay's on-the-ground work in the wind energy sector has shown him that offshore fixed turbines aren't just a promising piece of technology anymore. Despite limited implementation, it's quickly become competitive with coal and gas energy.
I was at the American Wind Energy Conference, and the number one theme there was renewables are now cheaper than coal and gas. And why on earth are we still only at 13% of our energy production coming from renewables? The U.S. is the most exciting market here. Offshore wind has always been this sort of niche, expensive European technology. And I think that's going to dramatically change over the next 5 or 10 years. You know, just to put some numbers around this, I think, you know, over the next decade, the offshore wind market could be 6 or 7 times the size of what it is today.
Currently, there's only one commercial offshore fixed bottom wind power plant in the United States. A 5-turbine project called the Block Island Wind Farm, just off the coast of Rhode Island. But that's set to change, according to a Department of Energy study.
The projection was 35% of the electric power in the United States would come from wind energy. And of that 35%, about 20% of that total would come from offshore sources. And that would relate to about 7% of the total power in the United States.
That's Walter Musial.
I'm a principal engineer at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. We're in Golden, Colorado. And I'm the manager and the principal investigator of the offshore wind energy projects that we are leading here.
While the Crown Estate manages the UK's wind energy sector, in the US, that work belongs to the Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Lab, or NREL.
Well, I've been working in this industry for 35 years now. Probably around the mid-2000s, early 2000s, we hit a turning point where we started to see Wall Street investors come in and wind farms be put in on large scale.
That momentum is inevitably leading us offshore, where investors are leasing tracts of ocean land from federal and state authorities.
They've sold 12 lease areas so far in the Atlantic Ocean exclusively. And in those lease areas, we have the potential now to install up to 14 gigawatts of offshore wind as a starting point.
But in areas off of the West Coast, the continental shelf drops off too quickly for conventional fixed turbines. That technology is constrained to depths of about 180 feet because of the need to embed foundations in the seafloor. Enter floating offshore wind turbine technology.
We're looking almost exclusively in the Pacific at deep water and almost exclusively at the development of the floating technologies that we've been talking about. And that's what will carry the day for Oregon, Washington, and California. And it's a big deal because floating technology is just starting to come around. 58% of the resources that are viable for technology development offshore in the United States are in deep water where floating technology will have to be developed.
And NREL is leading that charge in the U.S. The lab is to wind energy as NASA is to space. Walt Musial again.
Our mission is not to develop commercial systems that are already there, but to look at what's going to be commercial in 10 years from now. And we think that floating technology is among those technologies. And so we're working here to look at, well, what will it take to commercialize a floating system, not just build a prototype, but build systems that are cost effective and can compete with other renewable sources and other all energy sources for a spot on the electric grid.
But it's Europe that's closest to having viable floating technology ready to be rolled out on an industrial scale. The very first of its kind, a floating wind farm called Hywind Scotland, was completed last October by Norwegian energy giant Equinor. Stephen Bull, Equinor's Senior Vice President for Wind and Low Carbon, joined me by phone from Norway to talk about their pioneering efforts off the coast of Scotland.
It's about 30 kilometers off the coast, or it's just north of Aberdeen. So on a clear day, you can just about see the turbines. There's 5 of them. It produces 30 megawatts full output, and that's about enough for about 20,000 households in the UK.
The turbines at Hywind Scotland are a feat of advanced engineering. Using special crane vessels, a turbine soaring almost 600 feet into the air is affixed atop a vertical steel tube that's ballasted to float upright in the water, like a 260-foot buoy. That's like submerging the Statue of Liberty, then attaching the Seattle Space Needle to the top. The turbines are then suction anchored to the seabed and held in place by three mooring chains, each weighing 3,500 tons. As a young technology not yet commercially deployed, the costs remain high. But the momentum of a project like Hywind is helping to scale operations across the supply chain. Equinor's Stephen Bull again.
There are more vessels available. There are more companies wanting to sell and roll new steel. There are many more cable companies that are putting in better bids than they were previously. So this whole cost reduction across the total supply chain, plus we're getting better at doing this stuff as well, really goes to show that, you know, this could be competitive against many other energy sources in the future.
But is Hywind an outlier, or is it possible to replicate the success of floating wind farms here in the U.S.? Fidelity's Pranay Kirpalani sees several reasons why the wind turbine sector is poised to grow significantly in the near future.
A number of states, Massachusetts, New York, Rhode Island, New Jersey, Maryland, along the eastern coast, have access to some of the most powerful offshore wind conditions globally. And offshore wind is a very efficient technology in that it has a higher load factor than solar and onshore wind. So if you get it right, it can be a pretty powerful and efficient technology.
And that, he says, presents an interesting intersection between technological innovation and opportunities to expand reliance on renewable energy.
I think we're at a point now where the private sector can lead the charge. You're now seeing, I think, a higher environmental conscience among corporations. I think people are waking up to the fact that they have a social and environmental responsibility, causing companies like the large tech companies and the large Fortune 500 companies to contract directly with renewable operators to try build wind farms or solar farms. And the adoption can happen almost irrespective of any major changes in government. Government policy.
Harnessing the power of the wind in our oceans, once thought to be a dream of the Greek gods, is becoming a viable resource of sustainable energy. And as we continue to see cost-reducing innovations in wind turbines and the necessity of a solid seabed wash away, we begin to see a floatable future where a solid percentage of our power comes from the ocean breeze.
So I think the next decade, 2020 to 2030, we'll see an accelerated adoption of renewables. And I think we'll look back at 2018 and almost be surprised that we were so dependent on fossil fuels. I think that in 10, 15, 20 years, renewables could be a very large and maybe even generate the majority of energy that we use, not just in the US, but even in developing countries.
It's only been 18 years and we've grown from scratch a power technology that does 7.5% and that in 12 years' time will be doing about a third of our electricity. I think that's real spectacular growth. And with that growth come a whole raft of economic opportunities for businesses, for innovators, for small companies. And the bit that excites me is not only the fact that it's clean power, it's also the fact that it's providing such tremendous opportunities for the country.
Next time, big data is everywhere. In the last few years, we've created more data than has existed in almost all of human history. What happens when we use these data sets to analyze where and when people are getting sick?
Imagine what we as a society could do if we could track the spread of illness in real time. For people who are listening saying, gosh, can't we do that already? The answer until Kinsa came along was no, we're not even close. And it was one reason why flu affected nearly 1 in 5 people globally each year. It's a reason for why we are concerned about the next major pandemic. Our mission is to track and curb the spread of infectious illness.
On the next episode, Big Data is Spreading. The Future According to Now is a podcast from Fidelity Investments. To learn more or to get in touch, visit us at theatlantic.com/fidelitypodcast. You can listen on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Promotional content produced by Atlantic Rethink, the branded content studio at The Atlantic for Fidelity Investments, parentheses Fidelity. Fidelity and Atlantic Rethink, the branded content studio at The Atlantic, are independent entities. The views and opinions expressed by the speakers are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of Fidelity or its affiliates. Information presented is for information purposes only and is not investment advice or an offer of any particular security. This information must not be relied upon in making any investment decision. Fidelity cannot be held responsible for any type of loss incurred by applying any of the information presented. These views must not be relied relied upon is an indication of trading intent of any Fidelity fund or Fidelity advisor. Fidelity and the Fidelity Investments and Pyramid Design logo are registered service marks of FMR LLC, copyright 2018. FMR LLC, all rights reserved. Fidelity products and services are offered by Fidelity Brokerage Services LLC, member NYSE, SIPC, 900 Salem Street, Smithfield, Rhode Island, 02917, 848-668.1.0.